You're listening to Sipping on Some Crime podcast, hosted by Aaron. This podcast covers sensitive and triggering subjects, explicit language, and mature content which may not be suitable for children. As always, all parties are innocent until proven guilty.
Sipping on Some Crime. I'm your host, Aaron, and today we're going to do things a little different. Today is going to be chapter one of a mini-series, Seeking Diane. It's been 12 years since JT last saw his ex-girlfriend, Diane T. Francis. 12 years is how long it took JT to pick up the phone and call the Jacksonville, Florida Police Department to officially make a missing persons report for Diane. Just a few short days before JT places this call to the police department about his missing ex-girlfriend, his neighbor and friend, George Contos, goes missing May 9th, 2015, without a trace. George's vehicle is found a few days later abandoned by the side of the road and no sign of Contos. George's case is still active today. The thing is that JT supposedly wasn't even dating Diane at the time of her disappearance. A well-known associate of theirs, Foreman, was. If Diane was missing, why didn't Foreman report her? How does JT know she's missing? Is it connected, or is this just all a crazy coincidence? We'll come back to this. But let's first talk about Diane. Diane T. Francis was last seen November 27, 2005, in Jacksonville, Florida, where she was arrested on a trespassing violation. When officers arrived, they were already familiar with Diane, as she frequented the hotel and had been arrested by their department on a number of occasions for trespassing or drunk and disorderly. When officers arrived, Diane was with a male that wished to stay anonymous in the report. That report claimed that this man was Diane's husband. Diane has never been married. That is the last time we would have a positive sighting of Diane. Diane was held overnight and released the following morning. From there, we don't know what happened or where Diane went. Diane's father, David, states that his girlfriend Rita answered a call from her in 2006 around November asking for financial assistance and told Rita she wasn't doing very well. That's the last time anyone heard from Diane, so where did she go? It's clear this far that Diane struggled with substance abuse. She never stopped trying to be involved in her children's lives, and she always called her mother and father every holiday to check in. But the phone hasn't rang, no letters have arrived, and nobody has seen or heard from her since 2006. I, along with Diane's daughter, Sherry, are on the quest to find out what happened to her mother, Diane T. Francis. And the journey has been crazy and messy, but we are going to take the facts and start from there and try to solve this mystery of her mother's disappearance. The first question I get from here is, why didn't Diane's daughter report her missing? Diane's daughters were in foster care when she went missing. The girls didn't know she was really missing till a few years after getting out of foster care. To explain to you why Diane's father and mother never reported her missing, I can't answer that. We did get a chance to interview Rose, Diane's mother, and it gave us some insight into Diane's childhood and the dynamics of Diane's relationship with her parent. When Diane disappeared, we know she was struggling with substance abuse. We know she was getting sicker by the phone calls she made to her father in 2006. Diane has struggled with substance abuse since she was very young. Diane's father, David, said in her teens, she just met the wrong crowd and fell right in. When it came to men, Diane found abusive guy after abusive guy, and it's a pattern that never faded. Diane was first born to David and Rose Francis, July 7th, 1968, in Somerville, New Jersey. And David was head over heels in love with Diane from the moment he laid eyes on her. He'd prayed for a little girl, and when he found out Rose was pregnant with their first child and it was going to be a daughter, he was absolutely elated. Rose and David went on to have two more kids, Michael and David Jr. And according to her father, Diane bonded very quickly with her younger brothers, and they were all three very close. David states Diane did great in school as a child. In fact, she moved to advanced classes because of how quickly she learned. When Diane was 12, her parents got divorced. When you ask both David and Rose why they split, both will firmly state that it's for reasons they choose not to discuss. After the divorce, her father left Florida, where the family had been residing for a few years, and moved back to Jersey with his new girlfriend Rita and her three boys. Not long after David's move, Diane would choose to leave her mother and brothers and to move in with her dad in Jersey. David says it's because Diane and Rose were constantly arguing with one another and it just became too much. So Diane moved in with David, Rita, and the boys. Shortly after Diane left, her two brothers followed, leaving Rose. If you ask Rose why the kids left, she will tell you it's because they chose David over her. You can almost hear the pain in her voice as she changes the subject and dodges any questions she's uncomfortable with. It seems in her teen years, Diane was hanging out with the wrong crowd, experimenting in drugs and alcohol. She became pregnant at 16, but sadly, the baby would pass at birth. The father is unknown, and there are many rumors that surround that subject, so it's hard to narrow down any fact. Diane tended to date not the best guys, but she met Charles. Seems like she really tried to make it work with Charles, as they would have Jessica and Sherry together, and try for a few years to raise them together until Diane was caught cheating and Charles left. Diane adored her daughters and wanted them with her so badly, but Diane kept making poor choices, and her kids, unfortunately, were along for the ride. Sherry and I discuss what it was like growing up with Diane. Unfortunately, since Sherry and I both live on opposite sides of the country, our interviews are going to have to be done by phone, so the audio isn't perfect, and our first phone call's audio definitely isn't perfect, so please bear with us. In this call, you will notice that Sherry says John and JT. Those are actually the same person. We haven't decided whether to release their full names yet, even though they are available on the police reports. That's something that we'll try to feel out as we go from here. So just as a heads up, JT and John are the same person. You will also be hearing about a Foreman and a Schmidt, and we will be putting more details about who they were and are and their relationship with Diane. Most importantly, I just wanted you all to hear from Sherry about her mother, because it makes you want to get up and help her find her mother.
So let's see, where should we start? So I think you should start with just what you remember growing up, like up to where you remember not being with your mom, like how that all kind of built up from your side.
Well, I would say that early on, I, you know, just remember things being normal. Like, I have videos that I've watched of me and my sister dancing in a house in New Jersey with my dad. So this would have had to be before everything started. Dancing with my dad, we had this huge stereo cabinet. My sister loved to mess with it. It had one of those click glass front doors that you just push on it and it would pop out.
Oh, I loved those.
Yeah, and it was, like, taller than us. I mean, what kid didn't have one of those back in 1994?
Exactly.
So, just good memories in Jersey with them. And then I would say it all started when we moved to Florida, because that's where my mom met Schmidt. And, yeah, in that trailer park, she met him. So she left my dad and met him, and that was it. That was where the drugs started, and... Obviously, some weird things happened in that house with my sister and I and some of the other people staying there. I won't name names or anything like that, but we just remember some odd occurrences.
Right.
And, yeah, that's when the police started getting involved. My sister and I were removed from and my mother and his son was removed. And I believe his son went his own separate way, like to another state with family. And my sister and I think, went to, I want to say to Texas for a short period of time. My grandfather lived there. And I remember being in Texas. Now, don't quote me on the dates there with that, because that might have been a prior voluntary relinquishing of her rights. Like, I believe she gave us her family. So there was even instances where it wasn't on record. It's not going to be on paper because these were agreements in between the family and her, because she knew she wasn't doing well and she wanted to get better. So, yeah, we stayed with my grandpa for a short period of time in Texas with Rita. Rita was there. And then we were back with my mom within, like, 6 months to a year. And I want to say that John comes into the picture at this time, like, when we're coming back from foster care now. He would have been the boyfriend that she would be with. So it was like 1998, 1999 at this time. And so we're back with her and everything's great and dandy. And then the drugs and alcohol started again with John Boggs this time. So then we were removed again. I want to say I would have been like 5 or 6 at this time. And yeah, it was just a lot of abuse. We'll just say JT is his name for now then. And I would say I remember a lot of instances of abuse between them, but I wouldn't say that it was all the time. Like, I will give credit where credit is due. And there was times I remember John, and it was, you know, there was fun times. Like, I remember a time where they sealed the whole kitchen in Christmas paper, and it was obviously Christmas.
That's awesome.
We came out that morning and we were like told to break through it. Like, we had to break through the Christmas paper in order to get our gifts. And underneath there were 2 power wheels. I think Jessica got like the tomboy colored one and I got like a Barbie, whatever. I was like much more of a girly girl back then. Obviously life has gone to me, but back then I was like, Barbie, everything, Barbie this. So, yeah, there was good times, but, you know, I don't know if that was to mask the fact that, like, a few days later we were jumping on him, trying to get him off of my mom while he was choking her to death, or if it, you know, was genuine from the heart, like, he had a moment of sanity or clarity in his messed up nonsense of a brain and decided to do something nice. You know, I think mainly it was to cover the fact that he was totally and utterly, completely abusive to my mother. And they were like apology gifts, like, please still like me, don't, you know, that cycle of abuse where I'm going to abuse you, but then I'm going to do something nice for you, so I just completely confuse you. And well, that, and then like, she keeps staying.
Yes, yeah. And, you know, I think a big part of it, too, is like, you know, I know your kids are the most important thing to you. I see that no matter, you know, how important drugs are, how important alcohol is, you always come back on solid ground when it comes to your kids. And, like, you'll do anything to get them back, go through these classes. You know, your whole life is bent on the fact of, like, making sure your girls are safe. So if I do these nice things for them, like, at least they're still happy. At least they're still getting good things, right? Like, I could treat you like total crap, but remember, I'm doing this stuff for your kids. Like, your girls are safe. You still have a place right. to stay. So
holding it over her head, creating this, like, magical world for them so that he can abuse her.
Right. And, I mean, it got bad. I think I told you about the time that she, I don't know what the circumstance was. I was only, like, 4 years old, so obviously I don't remember what the spat was actually about. But I remember him just full force coming at her, punching her in the face, pulling on her hair. He was choking her, like, to death. And he picked her up and threw her across the house. My sister and I ran over to her. We were, like, on top of him, on the back of him, because they were on the couch. Jessica and I had jumped on his back with our little 5-year-old wrists. We were punching him as hard as we could,
right,
screaming,
like, trying to help,
you know,
mom.
Yeah, get off our mommy, stuff like that. Or like, you're killing her, get off of her. And I just remember looking at my sister like, he's going to kill her if we don't do something. And we dragged my mom off into the bedroom because where he had thrown her, she like hit the wall next to the room. And so we dragged her into the bedroom and slammed the door and locked it as fast as we could. And she got up once we were in the room, and he's banging on the door, let me in, you effing this, you effing that, you know, even screaming at me, my sister and I, and we're only like 4 and 5. So he punched his arm through the entire door and unlocked it and started coming in.
Oh, geez.
And I mean, the way I describe it is like Hulk smash, because it's literally like what it was. I don't know if it was because I was 4 and everything was like more dramatic in my life, because I was just a little kid, but it was like one of those splintered wood doors, and his arm just came through so bloody, and like, it was like out of a movie. And by the time got in, we climbed out the window, so we were safe. But the police were already in the front yard, I remember that, so someone had already called, because they probably heard the commotion.
Right.
And my mom still told us to lie and tell them that he would never hurt her or us. So make sure you tell them he didn't do anything.
Right. And you're wondering, like, why are we protecting this guy?
Yeah, exactly.
Hold on.
Exactly.
That's a hard message for a 4- and a 5-year-old to process. Like, wait a minute, this man almost killed us. But now we're going to go tell the people that can help us that he didn't.
And on contrary, like, I told them. It's in the report.
That, I love you. You're like,
I was like,
no.
Daddy beats mommy. Like, it happens. That's just what it is. I don't know.
I'm not gonna bullshit you.
Lady. Yeah.
But, you know, you just survived something massive. And to go up and tell, you know, kids that are so... Kids are just honest when they're little. Like, if they get asked a question, they generally just give their response. Like, and it literally just happened to you. So, of course, you're going to be like, no. Mm-mm. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, my sister, I think, said something along the lines of, like, he pushed her or something like that. Like, she tried to make it look less, and I think it's because she understood a little bit more, like, you know, where my mom was coming from. It was like, this is our place to stay. If you tell them this, they'll remove us. Like, yes, he's abusive, but it's nothing I can't handle. Like, it was more of like, you'll ruin our place to stay if you go ahead and tell them.
Like, she was almost used to the pattern. Like, when this would happen, now we have to go somewhere else with somebody else. Like, let's just stay here because we know this evil.
Yeah. So, yeah, I said, Daddy beats Mommy. I also told them that my mother's boyfriend pushes her around. I'm scared of him. I'm going into first grade, and I'm not afraid of my mom. That's what I told them.
Nice.
Jessica stated she is afraid of John. One time, John pushed her down, causing her to injure her mouth. And then he stated, but I never made her bleed. Those were his words.
Like, you know, I might have smacked her around, but she didn't bleed.
Like, I never made her bleed. Like, my interpretation of that is like, well, she's not dead.
Right.
You know? Exactly.
And how does somebody not pick up someone taking that report and not go, okay, that's a concerning statement?
Not only that, but like, things like this, the newspaper articles that I found or various people have sent me over the years just to like bring to my attention, like, hey, have you seen this one? And I'll be like, yes or no. Most of them involve John, and like, one was like he flipped a truck because he was driving under the influence on US-1, and it just shows the flipped vehicle in the middle of the road. So like, that's in the newspaper. Obviously all local police have like seen that, or they've heard of it, or when they look them up, that's kind of like attached to his record. Things like this are attached to his record. His neighbor going missing is not attached to his record, but I'm sure if you looked him up, that might show as him speaking in the news about it. You know, and then reporting my mom missing, that's on his record. And if you look John up as just an individual, you know, public criminal record, he's got a long history of violent occurrences, like battery or domestic violence or this or that. To me, this guy would be my first on the list. He is my first on the list. I'll just put that out there. But, you know,
I definitely feel like he's definitely high on the list. And was he in the house when you got taken away, when your Jessica got taken away? Was she still in that relationship with him?
Yes, I want to say, because there's two case files, I guess I'll call it, from foster care that I have in my own record that show him present. So the first one was the one I just read from a little bit, the quotes at least. Mentioned, let's see, she was with him in 1999, so I would say 1997 to 1999.
Okay, and you guys, so you believe you were pulled out by 97?
We were pulled out in 97 and 99.
Okay.
Now, I can't say anything else didn't happen in between those time periods, because those are the only records I have, but those
right.
are the, like, standout, you know, those reports have important details from those occurrences. Like, we might have been removed in 98. I just don't have the report from it.
Right. Like you said, it's super jumbled. Like, And even reports we have that don't make sense, like the last report we have of her with her husband who doesn't want to be mentioned.
Right.
It's such a big piece of, there's another like, okay, well, is that JT? Or is this some other interest, love interest she met? Because we know she wasn't married. We have no record of her getting married that we can find.
Right. So not only is it false information, but it's false covered up information. So, you know, we know he wasn't a husband, but even so, he asked to not be listed. So that makes it even harder.
Right. And why would you ask to not be listed? I mean, that whole thing's suspicious to me to begin with. Like, he's like, okay, I know she's getting arrested, but I don't want my name attached to any of this.
Right. And I think it's because, well, if he wasn't actually her husband, that could be a very good reason. Like, you know, this prostitute just came and paid me for sex, and I really don't want my name on this. She's claiming I'm her husband. I don't want to get her in trouble, so I'm not going to deny it. But at the same time, like, don't list me because, you know, I do have a wife and kids, or, you know, whatever the case may be. I don't know who this guy is.
Very true.
I don't know if this is the guy already on our person of interest list, but as of right now, you know, he's John. We don't know who he is right now.
Right, because that's our last official report of her, right? Like, known sighting. Someone knew where she was, had physical contact with her, took a mugshot of her. We have complete proof that she was seen that day.
I really wish we could, it's pretty invasive and it would be a lot of work, but I really wish we could find someone that was in jail at the time of 11/27/05 or 11/28/05, because mind you, it was an overnight hold just for like drunk and disorderly or something, and trespassing. So, but she was there overnight, and I just wonder so many times if like there's still someone there that's been in jail for like ever, and they're just like grandfathered in, and they talk to everybody who's anybody that comes in there. I just wonder if she might have told someone like, hey, as soon as I get released, this is where I'm going. I'm going to Georgia over here. It would just be so difficult because it's been so long. You know what I mean?
It's been so long. Even though someone just that spent the night with her in the drunk tank. Like,
right.
Was it one of those legit drunk tank cells where they throw two or three women in? They let them sleep it off. Did she talk to one of them? Do they remember her?
Right. Or like, were they so drunk that they probably wouldn't be able to tell us anything? Or like, who's to say she wasn't just that crab apple lady that was sitting in the corner like, I'm mad. I don't want to be here. Don't talk to me kind of thing too. Like,
true.
I could see her doing that when she's intoxicated, but
So you had two moms. How was sober, clean mom?
Sober, clean mom was like, I don't know, make you want to look for somebody for 15 years, you know? Yes. Just like someone you wouldn't be able to find ever again, you know, in anybody else or anyone like her. Any personality like hers. I have yet to find it, and I've been alive almost 30 years, so.
So she was the mom, and she loved her daughters. Like, you guys were her world.
For the most part, you know, like I said, when she was all there and she was a present mom, she was the best mom. Like, Jessica and I were dressed as twins from as far as I can remember. Though we weren't twins and we kind of hated it, it was just like we were her everything, you know? She wanted us to have it all. Like, we'd be dressed to the T all the time. Now, mind you, because I don't want anyone to think that my perception of my mother is just like, she was bomb.com, that's it, nobody, you know. No, when my mom did do drugs, it was bad, you know, real bad. I'm still suffering as an adult from some things that happened when I was a child. But it's almost like I've told you in the past, she had her own stuff. There was, you know, something there. You don't just go from perfectly picture perfect mother to like a switch goes off and now you're just this like drug addict lost cause. Like, I just, it was like a switch. She would either start thinking about something or, you know, influence from people around her and, you know, not blaming anyone else, but definitely her choice. But at the same time, like, she always needed a man.
What caused her to lean on?
Yeah.
Like, what caused her to seek it out? Why did she feel like she had to use it?
Or keep going back nonetheless too, you know, because it was like something that swallowed her numerous times. It wasn't just like she got into drugs, that was it. Like, her life went downhill from there. It was like she got into drugs,
She got us back. She got clean. She tried. She did all the classes, the counseling, the rehab, the detox, like all of it. She went through withdrawals numerous times. This happened 3 times before she lost us officially. And those are just the ones on paper. Like I told you, there was some voluntary, like, you know, her giving up her rights voluntarily because she knew she had an issue. So I would say this happened like 4 or 5 times before we were officially removed from her care for good.
Do you know what caused the state to finally say that's it? The report is very vague, but it's something like, you know, left the girls with a friend, so they were going to pay a light bill, ended up and would be back once they had the money to pay that, ended up spending money on drugs, took children. It's like a very...
I think that was actually the first occurrence of us being taken away, because that was with John Schmidt, so that would have been 1996. So the last time we were taken away, we lived with my mother, Roger, which we can omit his name later. I just don't know what we're going to call him yet because there's two of those two. So Roger Sr., Roger Jr., my sister, myself, and my mother, and we lived in a one-bedroom cottage. Now, that's 5 people, okay? With one bed. And the report from this removal is, like, I don't know if we'll ever get to the point of reading that on the podcast because it's disgusting. It just basically says they entered the cottage. It smelled of vomit. There was piles of dirty clothes stacked up in the corners of, you know, basically every corner of the cottage. There was pills all over this bookcase that was within arm's reach of both my sister and I, who were only 9 and 10 at the time. So Justin and I both had impetigo. I don't know if you guys don't know what that is. It's like a bacteria that grows from, like, your legs. It's from running around barefoot, just being dirty all the time, things like that. It said that we were not fed well, that there was prior reports. I guess they were just reports, like they didn't take action on it, but some of our friends in the neighborhood behind our cottages had reported that we were alone all the time or just kind of doing our own thing all the time. We were free to go and, you know, come as we please kind of thing. There was also a time period in that cottage where one of my really good friends, I won't say her name because she is actually, still currently in my life, but her and my sister and her sister were all running through the woods one time and she jumped over a log of some sort and tripped. Long story short, a piece of another tree, like, got lodged in her leg.
Ooh, ouch.
And it actually, like, opened her leg. We could see her bone and her muscle and everything. We're all screaming and we run up to the cottage and we're banging on the door, and Roger and my mom will not come out. They will not come out. I mean, we're screaming and crying. This girl is standing there bleeding, jeans ripped. I mean, it was bad. It was probably from her knee to, like, where your ankle starts, split open.
Oh, my gosh.
And so, long story short, we end up having to run all the way to their house, which is a couple blocks away. And this girl's in no condition to run. So when the ambulance and all that get there, then they have to investigate, you know, why my parents wouldn't open the door. And obviously, by that time, they had everything cleaned up. But it was just, you know, stuff like that throughout the end.
Right.
So,
and someone was finally like, that's it.
Right. That was in 2003, and there's a little snippet on my mom's Facebook page about that story when the caseworker comes. It's basically, Jessica and I knew what was happening. It was a routine. So as soon as we saw the lady pull up in her white car with her clipboard and her badge, her foster care badge or whatever,
right,
we ran out the back door and just started running. Running through the woods, you know, running as fast as we freaking could to try and not be taken away again. And we ran to that friend's house that I was actually just mentioning. And of course, you know, her mom being involved in law enforcement, sort of, she knew she had to call and tell them because it's, you know, aiding and abetting a runaway.
Right,
so
it's dangerous.
Right. So she called and they came and we were real upset and everything. But, you know, to me, it was like, well, she'll just do the classes and she'll just stop doing drugs. Like, they probably found drugs on her again. It's fine. Like, she'll just get clean again and we'll be back with her. And then I remember the judge notioning to move us to Fort Lauderdale to try and put some distance in between our mother and us because, you know, prior times that we were taken away, she would show up wherever we were and try and take us back or, you know, have us sneak out in the middle of the night to go back with her, which we knew was illegal and stuff like that. But all we cared about was seeing her or, you know, being around her. And
being as close to her as you can when you can. Like, you're like, okay, this is part of the process. Mom's going to get caught, get clean. We'll get her back.
Right. And I guess I just didn't really realize the seriousness of what TPR was. And that was the only thing that differed this time, you know, from the last two times that we were taken away by the state. TPR is termination of parental rights. Now, once they TPR'd my mom, that was it. Like, we were told, like, yeah, they'll be visitation still, just like the last times, like, it's gonna be fine. But they knew how much of an emotional volcano I was when it came to my mother. Like, you say the words not gonna see her, or like anything pointing towards like I'm not gonna get to be with her, and I'm gonna blow up, like, right in front of your face. Total tantrum. Yeah, I don't care. Yeah, like, I don't care if we're in the courtroom. More so when I was a kid, but I also used to, you know, when I was a child, I used to cry myself to sleep to the point where everyone in the neighborhood could hear me screaming, I want my mommy, like, in the middle of the night. And obviously I grew out of that more and more. I still have my days where I, you know, I go back to that feeling, but it's not as drastic as it used to be, because, you know, back then it was just like, make a scene, do whatever I can, they'll let me be with her. Now it's like, get yourself together and focus, or you're not going to be able to find her. So I can't be all emotionally clouded in the mind. But yeah, I used to just throw total fit in the courtroom. I mean, I wouldn't even go into school. I told you, I used to hang on to the poles in front of my elementary school and scream when she would drop me off, because I didn't know if she was going to be the one picking me up, or if it was going to be the lady in the white car with the clipboard picking me up. So
you didn't want her out of your sight, because you didn't, right. You weren't promised that she would be there again.
Right. And even if we were promised, it was really up to the drug and whether at that time they had a hold of her or not, because I don't even think that it was her choice after a while. Like I said, my mom chose to come back over and over and over again. That was her decision. She very well could have said, you know what, I suck, adopt these kids out. They're only 3 and 4. They won't even remember what happened. You know, like, as far as like choosing clean cut and just get it over with, she never chose the easy way out when it came to me and my sister. And I think right. That's what gets me with her disappearance, is I don't think that she would just up and disappear. I don't care how much drugs she did. I don't care how many boyfriends beat her, or, you know, whatever. It doesn't matter. Like, she repeatedly showed herself when it came to this, and then one day just stopped. Like, I don't ever see that being a thing. And now that I have my own son, I see it even less, because I see how much I care for him and like what I would do if anything like that ever happened. And I could see her love as a mother through becoming a mother, if that makes any sense. And
oh, it makes 1,000% sense. And you can't understand how she could leave you guys.
Yeah.
Because she never in a sense did. Even when she was in rehab, she wrote you.
Right. Or her parents or someone.
She was always checking on you, girl. And she always came back. And like you said, drugs weren't a choice. You guys were the choice. The drugs were the her own demons that she was trying to fight.
Right. I think, you know, a lot has to do with, like, you know, whatever she went through as a kid. I know that even with the horrible, horrible things that I've been through, and I've been through some horrible stuff, Erin, like some horrible stuff.
I can still
laugh about it, you know, and I just don't see that her horrible, horrible stuff outweighs the love that she had for her kids. Like, even the horrible things that I've been through, I could never just, like, look at my son and be like, you know, set him on the couch and be like, all right, this is it, I'm leaving. Like,
no.
I'd be like, all right, what purse are you going to fit in, because you ain't staying here, you know what I mean? Like, I could just never leave him behind.
No, you never would.
Yeah, and I see that being her attitude as well. I mean, don't get me wrong, she's her own person, and I don't know verbatim like what she was thinking, but I know for a long time she was thinking, I can't just leave these kids. I can't. And she kept coming back. So to just wipe her hands clean, I don't think that I could ever be that, you know. And maybe just tell me I'm living in some fantasy world, you can tell me that, but
no, because she did not just only not wipe her hands clean of you guys, but she called her mom like 6 months religiously, right? Like, on the clock. And they would talk for hours, and that stopped. And she always called dad same time around every holiday, and that stopped. So
yep.
It with all that, realistically putting yourself, saying that all out loud, hearing it all out loud, the fact that, you know, where do you think mom is then? Like, if at that you let yourself go to, she's not here.
Yeah. I don't know. That's all I can say for like 15 years now, you know. And when I ask everyone anyone else. That's basically the answer I get. And it's astonishing, too, because when I say that out loud, you know, when someone says, well, where do you think your mom could be right now? Or where do you think she is? And I have to say out loud that I don't know. That right there stirs up something inside of me that makes me want to call every detective that's ever lived in Florida ever. And, like, to know that my family is just out here telling people that, like, you know, an old friend, they come across an old friend, they're like, hey, how's Diane doing? Where's Diane? And my grandpa has to go, well, I don't know. I wonder if that ever stirs something in him, you know? Like, I just wonder about my entire family. If they're just out here answering questions about her like it's nothing and knowing that something could be very wrong and they're not even investigating it, you know?
Right, they're not making a report. They're not saying, hey, I know that her daughter's saying she's
getting
missing.
That feeling of, like, I don't even know, of like, judgment inside themselves, you know? Like, when I have to answer that and say I don't know to another person or say that for a whole nother year or even just another week, it makes me feel like I'm not doing enough. And I know, you know, don't get me wrong, I know I'm doing everything that I can, but, like, I just wonder if it gets them at night sometimes, you know, like...
Makes them want to get up and fight the next morning harder. Like,
right.
Really, we need to get involved. But none of them have called and reported her.
Right, and if I get that feeling at 2 o'clock in the morning, you better believe, like, I'm spending the rest of my entire morning researching, like, on my laptop all by myself in a cave somewhere.
Oh, 100%. You have... I wake up on the East Coast hours after, or should be hours before you, but somehow you've already been up and you have a whole dossier ready. You're like, look what I found. Like, let's talk about this.
Yeah, I mean, I get pretty serious about my researching, and like I said, I can't judge them. It's not my place, but at the same time, it does make me go, you know, sometimes just thinking about if they get the same feelings that I do. I know my grandfather does. He definitely has some, I don't know if it's guilt or remorse or what he's feeling there, but he definitely has some feelings about it, that's for sure. We'll just leave it at that.
Oh, yeah, he's complicated. Like, he's a whole episode himself. Like, I don't even know where to start with him, because you can tell that he's a father whose heart is broken, but there's also something else there, and it's really hard to read.
Yeah, and, like, I don't know if that's just the person he is. Don't get me wrong, like, you do have to remember, I knew my grandpa when I was, like, 4. Like, you know, you got a picture, you're living with your mom, life's great, everything's great, like, happy family, like, yeah, she switched boyfriends a couple times, but, like, we just won't pay attention to that. It's fine. Like, everything's still fine.
Glaze over it.
And then they're like, hey, we're just gonna drop you off in Texas with these old people. Like, it's fine. Just hang out here for a little bit. And we're like, okay. And, like, we knew he was our grandpa and everything, and we loved him, and we loved Rita, and, like, her spunky, you know, go-for-it attitude was always great. But, like, we knew my mom hated Rita, so, like, that brought conflict. Like, we didn't really want to get too close to her. It's not like we ever had an issue with her, but we knew there was something between her and my mom that wasn't good. And so we knew to just, like, not get too close to her.
Pick mom's side always.
Yes, 1,000%. Still. but, like, what little girl doesn't, you know? So, we didn't really know much about him. And then, you know, it was like Alice and Al were acquaintances of him and Rose. So when we went to go stay with them, we just knew they were friends of my grandparents. So it was like, now we're staying with these people that are associated with some people that we didn't know that we were stuck with. And then 9 years goes by after 2003, and we don't see him again until I decide to take it upon myself and sneak around and find my family in the middle of the night in foster care, and it just happened to be Rita's name that I found. So, like, there wasn't much relationship between my grandfather and my sister and I. Like, we always knew that he was my mom's protector, and he would show up at times and, like, throw her abusive boyfriend out, whomever it was at the time, but he was kind of just, like, big macho guy that stepped in to save the day every once in a while. It wasn't like we knew him, you know what I mean?
He was, like, legit, you know, like, Superman. He only showed up when there was an issue, and then he was gone.
Right? Like, that picture I sent you earlier today.
Yeah, it's just like, hey, I'm here to save the day. And okay, like, almost like he wanted to save the day for her, but he knew she was probably gonna make that decision again, and he just couldn't watch it. Like, I'm just gonna call me when you need me again. Well, I mean, I think that's a good place to leave it.
I know that audio ended abruptly. My apologies. The apartment complex I was renting at the time was very loud, and unfortunately, we had to end the conversation there. That was a lot of information to take in. Sherry and I are aware of how confusing the story is. Trying to piece someone's life together after they've been gone almost 15 years is not an easy task. Add in that she lived a transient lifestyle and interacted with so many different people, the puzzle pieces just get more distorted. However, Diane had core people that she stayed close to. We covered three of the men that were most prevalent in the police reports and foster care records because these men are the ones that had the most recent contact with her, as well as hung around the same circles. Sherry and I put together a timeline with the men's names, dates, and location that they were with Diane, so you can better understand what we covered in the first episode. If you visit the sippingonsomecrime.com website, we will have all the pictures and information on the case so you can follow along. It's so hard to tell this massive story. There's so many lies, rumors, and characters that it's hard to manage at times. I have to say, this is the most overwhelming case I have covered, and I have struggled with how to help Sherry tell it. Episode 2 will discuss her and Jessica coming out of foster care to discover that their mother wasn't just off with another guy somewhere, and not that she was keeping distance from the girls as the judge had ordered previously, but that she had truly vanished without a trace and no one was looking for her. There were three people who remained a constant in her life throughout the time of her disappearance: JT, Foreman, and her best friend, Melinda, that everyone lovingly called Fred. JT and Foreman's story have changed many times about the last time they saw Diane, and Fred has passed away before Sherry could talk with her. As time goes on, the window for finding Diane is getting smaller and smaller. Sherry and her sister deserve answers, and we are here in hopes that we can finally give them to them. I know this episode was a bit long and has so much info. Sherry and I want to thank you for taking time to listen to this episode, and we hope you'll join us for episode 2. In the meantime, during this quarantine, we have some personal recommendations for some amazing podcasts to check out. Voices for Justice, hosted by Sarah Turney, is an amazing podcast about the disappearance of her 17-year-old sister, Alyssa Turney. Be warned, this case will break your heart. I'm warning you, have some tissue ready. Naptime Nancy is another one of my favorites. Nancy covers cases with so much care and attention, and she has some of the cutest merch. So make sure to check out her store and her pod. And last but not least, the Great Unsolved podcast, where host Alexis covers many great cases in detail and always has a fresh take on what might have happened. Don't forget to hit that share button on Facebook and Twitter for missing and murdered families trying to get attention for their loved ones' cases. Every time you share a face, we get closer to solving that case. Until next time.